There's still time to change your mind. Live from London, this is the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Victoria Craig. Good morning. That's the message from the head of UEFA, soccer's governing body here in Europe. Alexander Čeferin said today club owners made a huge mistake in their move to create a new European Super League, which includes six leading clubs from England, three from Italy, and three from Spain. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is also opposed to such a move, which he calls ludicrous. And he's called a meeting with the English Football Association, the Premier League, and fan representatives today. For a little bit of background, if you missed it, over the weekend, 12 soccer teams revealed plans to create the new league, which would, in one sense, operate more like American sports. Members would be permanent and never face relegation. Currently, the existing rules see teams rise or fall within the ranks based on matches won or lost. In the last few days, then, fans have expressed fierce opposition to what they say would create unfair competition. The BBC's Alex Capstick explains how crucial today's meetings could be in determining what comes next.
It's not clear what exactly they can do to try and stop this from happening. Boris Johnson has said he wants to work closely with the football authorities, and he will do everything he can to make sure that this new league is not created. We heard from Florentino Perez. He's the president of Real Madrid, thought to be the driving force behind the European Super League. He was talking to Spanish TV and he said they simply had to do this, they had to make it happen because clubs were losing money.
We have to analyse why 40% of young people between 16 and 24 are no longer interested in football. So why? Well, because there are too many matches of poor quality and they aren't interested. We are doing this to save football, which is at a critical moment. Soccer has to evolve like life, like companies, people, mentalities. Social media has changed behaviour, and football has to change and adapt to the times we live in.
And do we know how committed these clubs are to the Super League? Would enough political pressure perhaps make them move away from that idea?
Well, that's difficult to know. Certainly they're going to be put under a lot of pressure, not just from politicians and from the football authorities, but also from fans. I mean, the backlash from fans in the countries of those clubs involved in the European Super League, they are against the idea. They don't want to see it happening. They say that the clubs have ignored the fans. It's a different message when you talk to football fans of the Premier League, La Liga in Spain, Serie A in Italy, because these are clubs which have a wide following internationally, and fans in Africa, fans in Asia, they quite like the idea of a league in which there are plenty of games between Juventus and Manchester United, between Real Madrid and Liverpool. They want to see more action from the big clubs and the best players. If you believe the rumours, then these clubs have signed a long contract with JP Morgan, which is the investment bank that has bankrolled this new league. They've invested, it's believed to be around $3.8 billion, so each of those 12 teams will get a huge lump sum.
At the same time, sort of on the other side of this, there are reports that UEFA, the governing body of soccer in Europe, is in discussions with a global investment firm for more than $7 billion in financing to overhaul the Champions League, which is the flagship tournament and what this Super League would sort of take teams away from. What would that need to look like to convince teams to back down from this Super League idea?
Well, the reason why these clubs have moved away from UEFA is because they have not got what they asked for from UEFA, which is a bigger share of the pie, more control of the Champions League and more money from the Champions League. They are short of funds. They have been making a big loss because of the pandemic. If you believe the figures from Deloitte, which takes a close look at the finances of football every year, there's been a drop in their revenues of the top 20 clubs in football around the world of 20%. That amounts to $8.2 billion. UEFA has announced a rebranding, a reformatting of the Champions League from 2024. So it'll be bigger, 36 teams, and there'll be more games. So that would equal more television revenue. But clearly, these clubs knew about that, but clearly that wasn't enough for them.
The BBC's Alex Capstick for us. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
As we check the numbers now, investors perhaps are a bit more cautious today over this Super League proposal. Shares of Italy's Juventus Football Club are down more than 8.5% after rocketing higher yesterday. Manchester United shares are up about 2.5% in the U.S. pre-market. Elsewhere, key European benchmarks are down in the 0.8 to 1.2% range. The Bank of England this week became the latest central bank to announce it's exploring the possibility of a central bank digital currency. It wouldn't replace the cash and coins we use every day, but be used alongside them. David Birch, a cryptocurrency expert and author of the book The Currency Cold War, explains the advantages of a digital pound or dollar for consumers like you and me.
Almost all money is digital now anyway. I mean, in the UK, I think 97% of all of the sterling is actually in the form of digital money sitting in banks. So the idea of a central bank digital currency, it's a digital form of cash. It goes from my phone to your phone, from my hat to your watch. It doesn't go through banks anymore. It goes from person to person.
And so what's the benefit of that?
If we go over to digital currency, can we save some money? Because obviously the cost of sending money from my phone to your phone or whatever is essentially zero. Can we cut costs like that? The answer is yes, you know. But more importantly, can we use it as a platform for innovation, for new products and new services? And that's really where I think the opportunity lies. If anybody can write some software that can instantly and essentially for free transfer money from one place to another, then you can imagine all sorts of new products and services.
And central banks, they've argued that it could be used as a way, if we look at the current pandemic, to deposit money into people's accounts directly rather than sending stimulus checks or set a time limit for that money to expire so that people are encouraged to use it rather than save it. Are those some of the most obvious benefits of using a central bank digital currency as opposed to the quote-unquote digital currency that we know now?
The drivers vary between different countries. I couldn't help but notice the irony, you know, this time a year ago, when in the same week, the US began printing and mailing out stimulus checks and China launched a digital currency in four cities. And in some countries, Latin America, for example, what the government did was say to people, look, we can get you your pandemic support, your stimulus money instantly. But to do that, you have to have a digital wallet. And the government instantly sent the money into those digital wallets.
So for consumers like you and me, what exactly does this mean and how does it work?
The simplest and cheapest way to do it would be you go to the Bank of England and get an account just like you get a Google Mail account. And you draw out money from your bank and you put it in your electronic wallet. And this opens up the possibility of new kinds of transactions. For example, yesterday I was on the phone to British Gas. They owe me £70, so they're going to post me a cheque. Now, that's a perfect example where when you're on the phone to them, I could have an electronic wallet on my phone, they could press a button and they could send the money instantly into my electronic wallet.
So basically, you can think of it like exchanging any other currency that you would exchange for, like if you were going on vacation and you wanted to change your dollars to pounds. It's sort of that way of thinking.
There's a sort of bigger picture in the background here. If we all have electronic wallets and those electronic wallets can store any currency we like, then round about probably 150, 160 of the world's currencies will disappear because an awful lot of people would much rather have digital dollars or I hope digital sterling in their wallets instead of their local currency.
And China seems to be the most advanced in trialing this concept. They've rolled it out. They've had hundreds of millions of dollars in transactions that have already been made in their digital currency. What's the advantage to China of being sort of the first mover here? And are other central banks really watching to see how that goes? Or are they sort of playing catch up now?
Some of the design decisions they've made in that rollout are really important. So for example, the ability to send digital currency from one device to another device in the absence of a network. If there's a hurricane and the mobile phone network has gone down or the electricity has gone out, you should still be able to send digital currency from your phone to the shopkeeper's phone to buy some food or something like that. But you can't decouple that, I don't think, from China's longer term strategy, the Belt and Road Initiative, and extending influence and I might even go so far as to say soft power. The digital yuan would be part of that. There'd be lots of people in lots of those countries, because they do most of their trade with China, who would be perfectly happy to hold a digital yuan in their wallets. It's fun to think about, you know, using your mobile phone to pay a road toll or buy something at a market. But it's important not to lose sight of the bigger picture around all of this.
There are real economic consequences to all of this, in other words.
One thing digital currency does is it expands the sort of toolbox available to the central bank. You know, you mentioned demurrage, money that expires, encourages people to spend it. You could also imagine things like negative interest rates and so on. I think for most people, the impact will be in new products and services that we can't quite imagine now. I mean, a very simple way of saying it is dollar bills don't have an API, but digital currency would have an API. And there are kids in garages that will build some fun products and services on top of it. That's where I think most people will see the impact.
It's fascinating stuff. David Birch, thank you so much for your time this morning.
You're more than welcome.
There's so much more to dive into on this topic, so I want to know, what questions do you have about digital currencies? You can tweet me at Victoria Craig or drop us an email. We're at marketplace@bbc.co.uk. In London, I'm Victoria Craig with the Marketplace Morning Report from the BBC World Service.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.